Mr. Stevens, we'll move on to the next case for this morning, Whipp against Kowalski.
May it please the court, counsel, if we'll move from the war on drugs to a war on gallbladders and change the pace here a little bit, my name is David Stevens, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Nikki Whipp, in this appeal of a jury verdict in a medical malpractice case, which will determine if cutting the wrong duct in a gallbladder removal is a violation of the standard of care, where all of the experts who testified agreed that the standard of care requires the conclusive identification of the proper duct to cut. I will, of course, argue that it is, and that errors in the admission of evidence and instructing the jury similarly require a new trial. I will ask this court to reverse the judgment of the district court and remand the cause for a new trial.
Of what state is Ms. Whipp, a citizen at this point, or when you started this case?
She was a citizen of New Orleans.
Louisiana. All right. I mean, New Orleans is almost a state, I recognize. But, I was just wondering.
In my opening brief, in the jurisdictional statement, I state that plaintiff was a citizen of the state of Louisiana. Defendants were a citizen of the state of Illinois and an Illinois professional corporation with its principal place of business in Illinois. So we had diversity jurisdiction in the court.
Now, the thing that I guess concerns me about your argument is the fact that there was plenty of expert testimony on the other side to indicate that under the circumstances of this particular operation, the failure to recognize the correct duct, the common bile duct versus the cystic duct, was not a violation, ultimately, of the standard of care, that this was, you know, a diseased organ, that's why it was being taken out, and that the doctor in question, Dr. Kowalski, had proceeded carefully and had immediately moved the patient to another place to correct the problem, and this is, in fact, a risk of the operation. So why wasn't that a jury question, finally, to decide which account of this to believe?
Because, Judge, there was a disconnect between the expert's statements of what constitutes the standard of care, and there was no dispute whatever that the requirement had not been met. That is, the agreement was that the standard of care requires the clear identification of the proper duct, and there was no dispute that the proper duct was not identified because the wrong duct was cut, thinking it was the proper duct. Now, defendants, I believe...
I really am not 100% satisfied with the way you're phrasing this, because the experts on the other side, I don't think they said that all general surgeons who make a mistake in identifying the common bile duct, you know, when it's glommed up behind the gallbladder or whatever, when it has the problems that it seemed to have here, have automatically committed medical malpractice, that there is, in fact, as is the case with the human body and generally, so much variation that if the person has taken the correct steps and has recognized and has unfortunately, I mean, nobody wants to make mistakes, but has unfortunately made a mistake, it may not be a violation of the standard of care.
That's correct, Judge. That's almost in a nutshell what they said and why they said it. But it doesn't square with their statement of what standard of care requires. And one of the defendant's experts, a doctor, I don't know how to pronounce it, Abacasis, I believe it is, he was their expert on damages, although he also gave an opinion on the standard of care. He went so far as to state that the physician must have 100% certainty in that identification. Now, conclusive identification of the proper duct, by definition, is proper identification of the duct. There'll be
But why wasn't it up to the jury to interpret what these experts were saying? I suppose you're putting your interpretation on them. But again, I guess the thing that troubles me about your case, this is a jury verdict. I mean, we aren't dealing with summary judgment. We aren't dealing with all of these things that require us to be very careful to make sure that the jury gets the case. Here the jury hears what your expert said, what Dr. Kowalski herself said, what the experts on the other side said, and they finally conclude that there was no malpractice here.
They did, Judge, and the burden here is quite high. This verdict must be shown to be against the manifest weight of the evidence.
Right.
And as this court has told us in, I think, 1984 in Roland Machinery Company versus Dresser Industries, that's abuse of discretion, my mistake. But against the manifest weight of the evidence is a very high standard. This court needs
to
determine.
You don't need to cite to it. We agree with you on that. It's a high standard.
This court needs to determine whether this disconnect between a statement of the standard of care saying that a certain act must be completed and the evidence being undisputed that that act was not, in fact, completed, if that allows the jury to make that determination that there was no negligence here. We assert that that, in fact, is not the case. Now, there was some discussion at trial, and I believe that counsel may argue, because it was in his brief, that the real standard of care is that the physician must be certain in her own mind that she's made the proper identification. Well, there was not agreement about this. Plaintiff's experts certainly did not agree to that statement of the standard of care. But if you look at it carefully, it's not a reasonable statement of a standard of care. I can reasonably identify one of you judges as Judge Easterbrook, but I would be wrong in that identification. Even if I was conclusive in my mind. I'm sorry, Judge.
I said, you just think you would be wrong.
We'll leave intellectual acumen out of it for the time being. But in any case, Judge, if you only have to be certain in your own mind, you can be wrong about a whole lot of things and still not commit negligence. We believe that although Dr. Kowalski testified that she was certain in her own mind that she had identified the proper disc to cut, she said in retrospect she was wrong. And she also said at another time, if she hadn't completely dissected enough to identify the proper duct, that it was her fault. Now, we're not going to argue that this is a judicial admission, but it certainly is a factual matter. In retrospect, she did not identify the proper duct coming out of the gallbladder. Anatomically, there is only one duct that exits the gallbladder. She thought she was right, and she wasn't. If we look into a parallel, for example, an automobile case, if you think you have a green light and go through an intersection and cause an accident, but it really was a red light, and you were just wrong about your conclusive identification of the green light, you were still negligent. That's the kind of thing that we have going on here.
Well, your argument almost sounds like a negligence per se argument, or what I would recognize under state law as a negligence per se argument, which there's no support in the context of a medical malpractice case for the use of negligence per se theory, is there?
No, there's not, Judge. And plaintiff's expert did testify that all he needed to know were two things, that there was a cut of the wrong duct, and that there was a misidentification, and that there would be negligence. It's very nearly, in his point of view, a negligence per se standard.
But you see, that's again where I think the defendant's experts, and the only reason I come to that is what we need to look for is, was there evidence before this jury that if the jury credited it, would support the jury's verdict? You know, in some sense, it's certainly not up to us, but if the evidence was there, then the jury could have credited. And I thought that the defendant's experts spoke about this particular case and the fact that the organ was deformed in a certain way and the duct was smushed up against the back of it. I know I'm not using proper medical terminology, but there were complexities that could have led a reasonable doctor performing at the correct standard of care to mistake the one duct for the other.
There were complexities in the case, Judge, and one of the options that the surgeon had available to her was to convert the closed procedure to an open procedure in order to clarify that ambiguity. She had that option available to her. She did not use it. And one of our allegations and one of the things that was presented to the jury, that the failure to open under ambiguous circumstances is a violation of the standard of care. That's an alternative theory that was presented to the jury. But, Judge, there are other reasons in addition to the disconnect between the standard of care and the uncontradicted evidence that require a new trial in this case. There were errors in the admission of evidence and also in instructing the jury related to the admission of evidence that amount to abuses of discretion on the part of the district court and prejudiced the plaintiff sufficiently to require a new trial in this matter. I will start with the use of a video by the defense in this case. On the advice of counsel, the defendant physician videotaped, or I suppose made a video recording because it was actually on a video disc at trial, of herself performing the same operation on another patient. And of course, there was no negligence in the second operation. Everything went just exactly the way it was supposed to go. This was shown to the jury in part, admitted into evidence, and amazingly enough, it was even part of the basis for the experts to formulate their opinions. They were able to say, well, I saw the video. Her technique is fine. She didn't make an error there. I don't believe she made an error here either. This is prejudicial for two reasons. First, it was a different operation on a different patient at a different time. It's not relevant to whether or not there was negligence in the operation on this patient at this time. And
well,
second...
Relevance is one of those things, though. I mean, does it advance the jury's understanding of the case at all? I would think it probably does advance the jury's understanding, or a district judge could reasonably decide without abusing discretion that it does. And I recall there was a cautionary instruction to the juries telling them this isn't the operation, this is not a videotape of Ms. Whipp's operation, this is a different thing. It's being admitted for more general reasons. And so we have to decide whether this was an abuse of discretion, right?
That's correct, Judge. There was a cautionary instruction that said the things that you just suggested that it did. Mm-hmm. Prior to trial, there was a motion in limine to bar the use of the video, and that was denied by the district court, as the district court denied almost, I believe, all of the motions in limine. And incidentally, counsel may suggest that because we didn't object to trial, that some of these issues are waived, and I would simply point to Federal Rule of Evidence 103A, which was amended in the year 2000, specifically stating that once you have a motion in limine, you don't have to object to trial in order to maintain an appeal. But in any case, once the motion in limine was denied, it was going to come in, and even with the cautionary instruction, it wasn't sufficient. It was showing this doctor performing this type of surgery on a different patient at a different time, seeing her be non-negligent, seeing her use good technique, and forming the basis of her experts' opinions that there was not a violation of the standard of care in this case. We believe that this is going too far, that it could only serve to confuse the jury. Now, we don't have any cases out of this court that we can cite that's directly on point, but I do cite a case from the Appellate Court of Illinois, Spruka versus County of Cook, a First District case from 2006. And in that case, the court found prejudicial error in counsel's use of an animation which purported to show their theory of causation. And the court
demonstrative testimony is used all the time in negligence cases, recreations of accidents or the like. I mean, I find it hard to imagine that there's some across-the-board rule that prohibits this in federal court.
No, I don't believe there is an across-the-board rule, Judge. In this case, I believe the rule is applied as it happened in this case. In the Spirka case, the court said that the animation tended to precondition the minds of the jurors to accept the theory of the defense. And interestingly, in that case, the Illinois Appellate Court cited the Appellate Division of the State of New York in Glusakis versus Johnny Hutchinson III, MDPC, 1989 appeal case in New York, disapproving the surgeon's video of defendant performing the same type of surgery exactly as in this case. So part of the basis for the finding of prejudice in Spirka was a case exactly similar to this in the state of New York. Now, there's nothing I found in federal jurisprudence that makes this per se unacceptable. But in this case, it preconditioned the minds of the jurors to accepting the case of the defense, and consequently was an abuse of the judge's discretion to allow it admitted into evidence and shown to the jury. Additionally,
if you want to save rebuttal time, you might want to do that because you're in your rebuttal time. If you don't,
I see, Judge. Thank you very much. I will retain, I'll rest on my brief and retain time for rebuttal.
That would be fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Borton.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, may it please the Court. Your Honor hit the key issues on the head with respect to their motion for a new trial because it's against the manifest weight of the evidence. We presented abundant, credible expert testimony on the issue of standard of care in this case. The facts are really not in dispute. On April the 17th, she came in with epigastric pain, saw Dr. Knauer. She'd had that for 4 years. She had an ultrasound the next day, which showed she had gallbladder disease, several large stones in the gallbladder. She's referred to Dr. Kowalski. She sees her on April 21, 2003. Dr. Kowalski recommends a laparoscopic cholecystectomy. She testifies that she discussed the risks of the procedures, the benefits of the procedures with the patient. Also, Holly Farley, her nurse, indicated she gave the patient literature about the procedure. Ms. Whiff denies all these things. She denies that they discussed the risks of the procedure with her. She denies receiving the literature. On May 1, 2003, the lap chole takes place. During the procedure, there's a common bile duct injury. The patient's transferred down to Barnes Hospital in St. Louis, where Dr. Linehan performs a hepaticojejunostomy. She also has...
I guess the point about your side of this case is there must be some things that if doctors get it wrong, they're just such glaringly bad things to get wrong that we can be pretty sure they violated the standard of care. They amputate the wrong leg. You know, they do something that's just so completely off base that no doctor who is performing up to the standard of care would do that. And so we have to kind of then zero in on this case with these various ducts coming out of the lobes of the liver and out of the gallbladder and decide, is this one of those things that until the doctor can really see the thing coming out of the gallbladder, whether it requires opening up the patient instead of doing it laparoscopically or whatever it takes, is it a violation of the standard of care to say, oh, looks like the cystic duct to me, clip, you know, and then it turns out that's not it?
That's right. There's a difference between res ipsa loquitur under Illinois law or strict liability offenses. And I can't believe that anyone's suggesting that this is a strict liability offense given the expert testimony in this case. Dr. Peckler testified that this anatomy can be extremely variable, extremely difficult to work with. There's a 0.3% incidence of common bile duct injury with all laparoscopic cholecystectomies. There's 2,100 of these on an average in a year in this country. And in this particular case, the circumstance was when she performed this procedure, this patient had a very small common bile duct. It was 3 millimeters in diameter, giving it the appearance of a cystic duct. That common bile duct was adhered so tightly with scar tissue from this patient's chronic disease to the gallbladder, it gave the appearance that it was entering the gallbladder. The real cystic duct was stuck back behind the gallbladder, adhered to it with scar tissue, removed completely from view of the surgeon. This case also had a redundant neck of the gallbladder because it had so many stones in it. As Dr. Peckler testified, it makes it extremely difficult to maneuver and obtain a view. So accordingly, when Dr. Kowalski...
But it wasn't negligence then to give up the laparoscopic technique and give yourself a little more room to...
The reason why that was not negligent in this particular case is because everything appeared exactly like it should appear. She performed 3 of the 4 maneuvers to identify the cystic duct here. She did the critical view, she did the infundibular technique, and she traced the cystic duct to where she believed it joins to the common bile duct. Okay, 3 of the 4 recognized methods were utilized. Everything appeared. She saw 2 structures, a cystic artery and what she believed to be a cystic duct entering the gallbladder. So in that scenario, a misidentification injury is not a breach of the standard of care. So testified Dr. Peckler. Misidentification injuries are the number one reason that we have common bile duct injuries with this type of procedure. Dr. Peckler even testified, I've had a misidentification injury. He's performed 3,500 laparoscopic cholecystectomies. You aren't going to find someone, he practices in Niles, Illinois, board-certified general surgeon who has more experience than he does with lap choles, a procedure invented in the early 1990s that he became very proficient at. We also had testimony from Dr. Abacasis. He is the head of transplant surgery at Northwestern. I would be very interested to tell Dr. Abacasis that he had a disconnect with respect to his testimony on standard of care. His credentials are impeccable. He's the one who repairs these type of injuries. He testified that usually what I see is a very high-level injury because the surgeon is not as meticulous in their dissection as Dr. Kowalski was, and they typically don't recognize this injury during the procedure. He testified unequivocally she did not breach the standard of care.
Now, did you argue to the jury the fact that she identified the injury right away was somehow evidence that the standard of care was not breached?
Well, Dr. Peckler testified that there are four instances in which he would consider to be malpractice regarding a lab Coley procedure, and one of them is not to recognize the injury intraoperatively. And she did recognize it intraoperatively, indicating that she was not being careless. She was being very careful in her dissection and how she approached this procedure. They indicate very interestingly in their brief that all experts agree that conclusive identification of the cystic duct is required. All experts did not agree to that statement. If you look at their brief at page 36, there's no citation after that in the record. And they've never cited in the reply to it where this is indicated in the record. We went back through the testimony, and we cited in our response the testimony of Dr. Peckler and Abacasis on these particular issues. At page 426 of the transcript, Dr. Peckler was asked by the plaintiff's counsel on cross-examination, standard of care does require conclusive identification of the cystic duct and cystic artery before they are transected. Answer, you need to satisfy in your mind that you have identified these structures correctly. Dr. Abacasis gave the same testimony. And what they're talking about when Dr. Abacasis is saying 100% certainty is they asked him, well, doctor, what if you're about 70% certain? Is it okay to take the cystic duct? He goes, no surgeon takes the duct unless they are certain in their mind that that's the duct. You can't be 70% pregnant. Not all experts agreed that conclusive identification or a misidentification is always a breach of the standard of care. Their motion is based on an inaccurate reading of the record. The next issue they talk about is the video. I guess I'll address that next. The trial court has broad discretion with respect to admission of demonstrative evidence, and there's good reason for that. Here at trial, the objection they made in their motion in limine is they said, you know what, this exhibit does not show Ms. Wiff's anatomy. Therefore, it should be excluded as irrelevant. Well, we argued to the court, and the court agreed, none of plaintiff's demonstrative exhibits, and there are numerous of them in the record, none of them reflect Ms. Wiff's anatomy. So the judge correctly identified that's going to go to the weight that the jury's going to give this. Accordingly, the video was shown. It was shown for two purposes. It was shown for the purpose of educating the jury about this procedure. How can they decide issues of standard of care if they don't understand what the anatomy looks like, if they don't understand the instruments involved, if they can't understand the view that the surgeon is going to obtain from this procedure? That's why it was shown to the jury. Also, a testimony, Dr. Klier, while not disclosed, testified that the three trocar technique utilized by Dr. Kowalski did not allow for adequate lateral retraction. We demonstrated in the three trocar technique that you can obtain adequate lateral retraction when doing the procedure.
I don't know. Did you define that technique for the jury? What is that technique?
Lateral retraction?
No, three trocar.
Three trocar technique, yes. In essence, what you do is instead of using four ports, she uses three. And he's saying, you know, it's negligence to use a three trocar technique, although she's learned that during a 5-year residency at the SIU School of Medicine. The plaintiff's cases are clearly distinguishable. Spryka was a video that was not timely disclosed. They didn't make a timely disclosure, and the court said we can exclude it on that basis. We don't have that issue here. This was timely disclosed when we disclosed our expert witnesses months before trial. In Spryka, they said, listen, this is more than a demonstrative exhibit. This is a recreation of events. And they also, what they were trying to show was that a DVT developed in a very short period of time, traveled, caused a pulmonary embolism that resulted in the patient's death. And they said there's no testimony, there's no evidence that a clot formed in this time frame as shown by the video. So there was a real disconnect between the video and the testimony in that case. Then they talk about the New York case, the Gluskakis case versus Hutchison. In there, they showed a different kind of procedure. They were showing a coronary bypass graft while the surgery at issue was a totally different type of coronary procedure. They also admitted that it took much longer in that video than it actually took during the surgery. Also, they indicated that the defendant's expert testified that it was overdone.
But don't you think you could have shown all of the things that you legitimately needed to show if it had been, Dr. Jones doing the procedure, not Dr. Kowalski, and you wouldn't have had any of the problems of shading the jury's view of the particular case in front of you?
You're right, and I can tell you exactly why I did this. Because I knew, when you have a situation where you know that the initial allegations against you, that she doesn't dissect down from the gallbladder, when the operative report clearly indicates she does dissect down from the gallbladder, and that's what kind of the opinions that their expert was having, that they're going to grasp onto something else when we go to trial. I'm going to get a movement of their opinions, and I got that movement. The movement was going to be about the three trocar technique, and I knew that. I mean, it's the only thing Dr. Kowalski does that's different than what the other experts do. They use a four trocar technique. So I needed to show my experts the three trocar technique in case they attacked it. And did they attack it? Yeah. They said, you know what? You can't get lateral retraction with a three trocar technique. And I needed that video of a three trocar technique to demonstrate the adequate lateral retraction.
Someone else at SIU must be using the three trocar technique, if that's where she learned it.
It's possible, but I don't think there's a per se rule, as you pointed out earlier, that a demonstrative exhibit prepared by a defendant necessarily has to be excluded. It does not. There is no such rule. And the issue is faced is whether or not it's going to assist the jury in understanding the facts. And the trial court reasonably concluded that it did. And the trial court also has the benefit of reviewing the video and the testimony, and I would submit that there was no objection during any of the testimony of Dr. Kowalski about her description of the video, and the trial court got to see it. It's not included even on the record on appeal. None of the exhibits objected to are included in the record on appeal. The issue of informed consent was also objected to. Plaintiff really played fast and loose with this issue. Going into trial, we had a complaint that said that the defendant was otherwise negligent. And we pointed out to the court this could mean virtually anything, including a lack of informed consent. And we were afraid that they were going to do that because Dr. Clyer had testified in his deposition, and this is in the record as well, that he believed that if Ms. Whiff was correct, that the risks of the procedure were not discussed with her on April 21, that Dr. Kowalski breached the standard of care with respect to informed consent. So we're sitting there in trial not knowing what they're going to do with informed consent. Then they start introducing evidence on informed consent through the first witness in the case, Dr. Pikus, the interventional radiologist, is asked about informed consent. Then they ask their own expert about the issue of informed consent. We begin to cross-examine him on informed consent. We have a sidebar on that issue, and the court properly recognized, counsel, you've opened the door. So we were allowed to cross-examination on the issue of informed consent. Then plaintiff made a strategic move at that point in time. When they went into redirect of Dr. Clyer, they elicited testimony from him that, yes, Dr. Kowalski breached the standard of care if she did not have this discussion on April 21 regarding the risks of the procedure. Then they introduced evidence from Ms. Whiff. No, she did not disclose any of these risks to me about the procedure. Then they called Dr. Kowalski adversely and asked her about what she discusses with her patient. They brought into this issue informed consent. They certainly opened the door, and it was not until we got the jury instructions as to what the issues were that we knew for certain informed consent was not going to be an issue in this case. They alleged that our other demonstrative exhibits, defendants 7A, B, and C, which are not part of the record, also are inaccurate depictions of Ms. Whiff's anatomy. Actually, they asked Dr. Peckler on cross-examination if he thought they were accurate. He said, yes, based on the testimony I've reviewed in this case and based on the medical records, these are accurate depictions of the anatomy. I'm not sure what they're contending is inaccurate about 7A, B, and C, because Dr. Clyer testified he has no idea what the anatomy appeared like. They indicate that it was error for the trial court to allow questioning of Dr. Clyer on cross-examination, that this was Dr. Kowalski's only common bile duct injury. They raised a motion in limine on this issue, but if you look at page 11 of the final pretrial proceedings, the trial court indicated, I'm reserving ruling on this. I want to see how the evidence comes in on this issue. And the trial court admonished us completely throughout that final pretrial proceeding of, listen, I don't like motions in limine. I like to see how the evidence comes in. We're all experienced counsel. Stand up, make your objections. I'll instruct the jury not to regard your objections as being anything improper, and I'll make rulings at trial. Counsel, go make your rulings at trial. How they can get from that, suggesting that as a definitive ruling on all these motions in limine, I don't understand. They clearly knew they had to make these objections, and they did. I would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the trial court. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Stevens, anything more? How much time? You have a minute, Mr. Stevens.
Thank you, Judge. Very briefly, with regard to demonstrative exhibits 7A, 7B, and 7C, the way that these things were set up was very prejudicial. There was a diagram that was labeled normal anatomy. There was another anatomy. There was another diagram that was labeled Nikki Whip's anatomy. The implication is clear that it's abnormal, and consequently this was her fault in some way. The use of those was highly prejudicial. But the main thing I would say in rebuttal has to do with counsel's suggestion that Dr. Kowalski used 3 out of 4 techniques to make sure that she was cutting the right duct. Well, 3 out of 4 is 75%. If she'd used all 4 techniques, she wouldn't have cut the wrong duct. She did 3 things, she cut the wrong duct. If she had done 4, she probably wouldn't have. This is a violation of the standard of care. We ask this court to reverse the judgment of the district court and remand this cause for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.